Just as we seem to turn a corner in the fight against COVID, there's growing concerns about new variants and how this virus is mutating to continue to infect people. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists in the UK, they identified a far more contagious strain, B.1.1.7, that was late last year and that has since surfaced in multiple counties in Wisconsin. What do you want to know about the current strains and how they affect the spread of infections here? It's 800-642-1234. Ellen Bateman is director of the Communicable Disease Division of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Ellen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. Glad to be back.
I feel like we've come full circle with you. You know, a year ago this month, you were here discussing the urgent need to keep up with testing and lab capacity for the volume of specimens you were getting and enough reagents. And I'm just wondering, can you give us a capsule of what the Communicable Disease Division has been through in the seasons of the first year of the pandemic?
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's great to be back. Last March, we were definitely under the gun with a lot of testing, PCR testing, to determine if people are positive and negative. And we were one of the first labs to be up and running in the state doing that testing. And then we helped a lot of other labs in the state bring on their testing and scale up as well. So we're in a much different, much better place now for PCR testing capacity around the state, that a lot of labs have more capacity than samples coming in right now, actually, which is a much, much better place to be than a year ago.
Is the State Lab of Hygiene still doing specimen testing, though, PCR testing?
Yes, we are. Yep, we have certain criteria for individuals who meet public health criteria for testing here. The vast majority of testing statewide is done at other labs, other large high-throughput labs, and many clinical labs. Over 100 different labs around the state are doing the majority of the testing, but we still definitely do certain public health criteria testing as well. Yep.
What have you learned in this year? What has been the big lesson learned?
Well, I think for us at the state lab, it is kind of a vindication of what we've done for a while, which is have connections with clinical labs around the state. And we coordinate something called the Wisconsin Clinical Lab Network. So already, 20 or 25 years ago, we started this, and we maintain these relationships with all of the 130 labs around the state for ongoing communication. We provide some continuing education for them, and we ask them for specimens for our normal public health surveillance things, for influenza and for other outbreaks of things. And that really served us well in this response, to be able to immediately communicate with all the labs and help get them up and running, because we knew that we couldn't do this all alone. This is the scale of this is way beyond anything else that we've really experienced. So that was a really good to have that experience and know that really this network is really powerful.
Yeah, you had a network in place to have that communication happen when you needed it. I want to get into these mutations that are showing up around the world. What can you tell us, not only about the UK variant, but others that we're seeing in Brazil and South Africa?
Yeah, sure. So I guess we've been following the virus for the past year now, and we and others worldwide have been doing sequencing, which is just a more in-depth look at the virus. And sequencing allows us to look at individual mutations of the virus, and all viruses mutate. But for most of 2020, the virus was honestly relatively boring and didn't mutate all that much or all that importantly that we could tell. But then, as you mentioned, the variant initially in the UK back in December, and then there have been two more now for a total of three variants of concern. One identified in South Africa originally and one identified in Brazil originally. All of them have since spread to many countries around the world, and the science and our knowledge of them is changing daily. So we're still learning a lot more about them, but as you mentioned, they are more contagious, more infectious, and there might be some instances where they could get around some immunity as well. But we're still learning a lot about that, and the reason why they're variants of concern is because we need to learn more about them and to track them.
There are multiple reports of this more contagious B117 strain in Dane County, Eau Claire, Waukesha, now Kenosha County. Is the strain more widespread than this? What are you finding?
Sure. Yeah. So we and everyone else in the U.S. and the world only sequence a subset to get a sense of which strains are really out there. And we're quite sure that both in Wisconsin and worldwide, there are many more identifications or more instances, more infections with these variants than are identified. But we do have decent capacity here in Wisconsin to be able to do the sequencing that's needed to track these variants, and we and others are continuing to scale up. Would it be helpful if I talk just for a minute or two about what the sequencing is?
Let me just pause there and reintroduce you. Alan Bateman is director of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene Communicable Disease Division. We're discussing variants of the virus that are beginning to spread more widely and more rapidly throughout the country. And Alan's taking your questions about these variants at 800-642-1234. Let's just take a call right now. Lisa has a question in Madison. Lisa, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I've been paying close attention to the in Manaus in Brazil, where people thought they had essentially reached herd immunity with the initial pass through of the virus. And then with this new variant, it's just ripping through the city. And then my concern off that is if the wealthy countries are going to essentially hoard the vaccine or not ensure that poor countries can receive it, these variants are going to continue to produce and the pandemic is going to rage on. And what are we going to be doing to address that problem?
Lisa, thank you so much for those great questions. Alan.
Yeah. So there is a WHO real push to get vaccines to every country in the world. And there have been a lot of differences right now in terms of which countries are moving faster or moving slower for many different reasons on the vaccinations. And I think the point is a good one, that we do need vaccination worldwide to be able to continue to drive down the infections overall, because there could be additional variants that continue to pop up. I will say in Brazil, there does seem to be another peak or another round of infections in Manaus, and some of that does seem to be people who have been infected with a previous strain before. But the science is moving so quickly, and it does seem like the prior immunity from people being infected might not be quite as strong as people who are vaccinated, which is yet another reason to really push the vaccines. And I also just want to make sure this is relatively balanced, that yes, these are variants of concern. Yes, we need to track them, but I don't want to be total chicken little sky is falling, because we do know that the precautions that we do also work against these variants. The UK and other countries that have implemented more masking and distancing have been able to drive infections with these variants down as well. So even though they're a variant, it is still the coronavirus that's causing COVID-19, and a lot of the precautions still work against the variants.
And I just looked at the CDC map that shows its variant map that Wisconsin has no cases yet of the P1 variant that is in Brazil, that is wreaking havoc in Brazil, but that could change.
Yes, that could definitely change. I know that Minnesota has identified just a couple, and so that's why we continue to do general strain surveillance to be able to track which exact variants, which exact strains are common in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Alan Bateman about COVID variants and genomic testing. We'll get more into that. He's director of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene Communicable Disease Division. Have you received your COVID vaccine yet? Are you concerned about virus mutations? What do you want to know about testing and the bench science in the fight against COVID? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alan Bateman here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene trying to spot mutations of the coronavirus through sequencing the genomes of hundreds of virus specimens each week. Scientists, they're keeping a close watch on mutations that have made the virus more contagious. What do you want to know about this? 800-642-1234. Alan Bateman is director of the Communicable Disease Division at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in another call. David is with us from Eastman this morning. Hi, David. What is your question?
Yeah, good morning. question. These variants have been around in the U.S. for a while. I'm not sure if it's a South African strain or the British strain that was first discovered in South Carolina several weeks ago. But with case rates dropping all across the country, if these are, you know, that significantly more contagious, why haven't we seen some spikes in cases? And when would you anticipate that we're going to see these spikes if, you know, these various strains are widespread across the country?
Yeah, David, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David. That's a very good question. I will say I'm very happy that there haven't been an increase yet. It's really hard to know what's going to happen in the future, but that's why we're keeping a close eye on these, both cases overall and also the variants. We do know that the percentage of all the positives that are variants, that has increased, so the variants are becoming a bit more common. But as I mentioned before, even though this is definitely something to track, we don't want to blow this out of proportion, and we want to keep a close eye on it, but not worry too much. And really, the same mitigation measures, the same protection measures also work against these variants.
In terms of the amount of surveillance testing for these variants, the director of the CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, said last night on All Things Considered that this effort has really ramped up nationwide recently.
When I came in, we were testing only about 250 samples a week for surveillance for these variants. Now we're up to somewhere between 9 to 15,000 surveillance tests a week, and we're working hard over the next few weeks ahead to ensure more and more surveillance testing.
Is there enough surveillance testing happening now in Wisconsin?
Yeah, good question. We do feel really proud about where we are currently with the surveillance testing in Wisconsin. There are four labs, so it's us and three other labs in the state that are doing testing, and we're among the leaders of the states. I think the CDC has a website now, and I think we've done the fifth most sequence testing of any state, and that includes all the states that have much higher populations than ours as well. So we're starting from a really good baseline, and we feel pretty good. There have been some goals thrown out there of to sequence 5% of all positives or 10% of all positives. Currently, where we are right now, our capacity is somewhere between 10 to 15% of all positives in Wisconsin right now. So we're starting from a pretty good place, and we're still planning to scale up capacity as well.
Let's bring in Sandy now in Sun Prairie. Sandy, hi. You want to talk about a genome sequencing?
Yeah, I guess kind of piggybacking off what your guest had just mentioned, it had been reported in the UK that they had been actually pretty aggressive about the genome sequencing early on, and the United States has been lagging behind. It's good to hear that Wisconsin is picking up the pace with that, but I guess I was wondering what the guest had to say about the fact or the outlook across the United States now that we've been kind of behind the times as far as tracing all of the variants.
Yeah, that's a great question. Nationwide, from a lot of 2020, there was a consortium that CDC put together called SPHERES. It was relatively it was anyone who wanted to join could join to get some standardization around this surveillance testing, but there weren't quite as many things happening in an organized fashion nationwide. And I think CDC's really the past couple of months taken that and really moved to change that. And they've implemented quite a few different approaches to be able to scale up this surveillance testing nationwide. So I know that nationwide that we've already made progress, and I expect that to continue to increase.
Talking with Alan Bateman, director of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene Communicable Disease Division, we're discussing variants of the virus that are beginning to spread more widely and more rapidly throughout the country. Taking your questions about them, 800-642-1234. We have another Alan. Alan here in Madison with a question. Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hi, Alan. So I guess I wanted to ask a little bit about how the sequencing actually works and how you decide which 10 to 15% of positive cases warrant the further sequencing.
Great question. I'll start with the second one first. How we choose which proportion to sequence. So we're taking a couple different approaches. One is a general approach of geographic distribution and trying to get the best overall statewide picture that we can. So there are three other labs, and they're primarily focused in the counties and the regions right around where they are. And so we at the state lab then can focus on the rest of the state and really try to have as best geographic spread of the surveillance as possible. In terms of how we actually do the sequencing, I don't want to get too technical, but comparing it to PCR, so PCR tells you yes or no, is it there or not, are they positive or negative? And PCR looks at one or two specific parts of the virus genome, whereas the sequencing that we do, it's called whole genome sequencing, so we're actually reading out the entire genome, all 29,000 letters of the genome, and it allows you to do a lot of different things in-depth analysis-wise. One is to identify variants. Another one is to, you can look at individual viruses and say how closely related they are. So there are a lot of different applications in terms of outbreak response or transmission that you can look at. You can see if a healthcare worker who's, it was some colleagues here at UW-Madison looked at a healthcare worker who became positive, and this healthcare worker was treating some COVID patients, but also the healthcare worker's family was sick. And so they wanted to know where it was likely that this healthcare worker got it from. And it turns out that the virus that the healthcare worker had was much more closely related to their family's virus, which suggests that it came from the community, from their family, and didn't come in their workplace. And so that really was helpful to inform the PPE and the infection control in their hospital.
Well, along these lines of this kind of detective work, I'm wondering, you know, because we've heard these reports that in Brazil, this more contagious strain, you know, ripping across Brazil appears to be infecting some people who have already recovered from another version of the virus. Is it true that there's really no way to be sure what is happening to people who are reinfected unless you have both their old and their new samples and you're both genetically sequencing and comparing them?
That's the best way to tell and to actually prove if it's a reinfection. And that's the other part I was going to say in terms of how we choose which ones to sequence. We work with our colleagues at the Department of Health Services, and they put out a health alert network to all clinicians around the state for patients who meet certain criteria that might be high risk for a variant. So someone who's COVID positive who recently traveled internationally, or someone who is COVID positive who had has already had two doses of vaccine, or someone who's COVID positive who has had a second infection, so it appears to be a reinfection. And then we'll sequence those because those are kind of enriching for potential variants as well.
Let's bring in Jim now in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, hi. Jim, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Hello? Now. Go ahead. Hi.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if your agency makes any recommendations as to the number of cycles of PCR tests are run. In Florida, they just passed a law, I believe, to require that be reported along with the results. And I think it's especially important since Dr. Fauci said that over 35 cycles, those tests are meaningless. I found out that our local lab here is running at 45 cycles. At 35 cycles, the tests are 97.3% false positives. And also, you said the test identifies whether you, yes or no, have the virus. Dr. Kerry Mullis, who invented that test, and in fact won a Nobel Prize for inventing it, said that it's not to be used for medical diagnosis. It does not detect whether you have a virus or not. It could be a genetic fragment that could be there from that virus or another related virus.
Okay. So in terms of the cycles for PCR, the tests that we use and most other labs use have FDA emergency use authorization, and there are many different factors that go into each test, the way it's designed, not just the cycles, and each one of those has been rigorously determined to have high sensitivity and high specificity. And in addition, every lab that implements a test does their own in-house comparison and validation to make sure that the test works. And anything that has the FDA authorization cannot be changed. Mm. So that is set nationally by the FDA. And I will say for PCR, it is a routine diagnosis worldwide. It's the standard, it's the gold standard for diagnostic tests worldwide.
As we start to wrap up here, what do you expect in the next coming months to look like for your lab's work and, you know, in terms of the testing, in terms of the genomic testing, what do the next few months look like?
Yeah, we plan to continue to scale up the ability to do the genomic surveillance testing, both by additional training of staff that we have here, as well as purchasing higher throughput instrumentation. This is actually a great opportunity for us to build up our ability to do more sequencing for anything. So sequencing is a great tool that we've used for many years, and we've had a certain amount of capacity for it, but to be able to really do it at scale for a lot of things, antibiotic, bacteria, tuberculosis, influenza, it'll be really nice to be able to scale up and have better surveillance for many public health, many pathogens with public health importance.
Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Alan Bateman is director of the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene Communicable Disease Division. Ahead this hour, we have Marquette University's provost and how it's weathering the financial fallout from the pandemic and planning to reopen campus for in-person instruction in the fall. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been nearly 3 years since former President Donald Trump and former Governor Scott Walker broke ground on Foxconn's planned manufacturing facilities in Mount Pleasant. They made big promises about the impact Foxconn would have on every part of the state. As Corrine Hess reports, almost none of those promises have come true.
Last week, Foxconn executives announced plans to begin manufacturing electric vehicles for a California-based startup. In a joint statement, the companies boasted the collaboration will revolutionize the automotive industry, comparing themselves to Isaac Newton. It wasn't the first time Foxconn has announced an attention-grabbing partnership. In 2019, the company was going to make automated coffee kiosks. In 2020, it was ventilators. But both projects ended soon after being announced. Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz is a longtime critic of Foxconn.
Everything that they've promised so far, none of it has been true, and none of it has played out.
In 2017, Foxconn claimed it would create 13,000 jobs in the state. Hintz says Wisconsin operations have appeared to be virtually non-existent.
From the beginning, the lack of transparency, the lack of honesty, and the lack of accountability from Foxconn really plagued their overall project and investment.
Since Foxconn became a known entity in Wisconsin, the company has made promises across the state. For some people, Foxconn's arrival 3 years ago brought hope for more than just a massive manufacturing campus in southeastern Wisconsin. The worldwide company's arrival here brought a dream for new technologies and new educational opportunities. In 2019, Foxconn announced it would locate its North American headquarters in downtown Milwaukee. The company promised 500 research and development employees in the city. Milwaukee's Common Council member, Robert Bauman, whose district includes downtown Milwaukee, says he hasn't heard from Foxconn since the announcement. He says he was skeptical from the beginning.
But, these were the claims they were making, so they obviously were a huge employer, very large worldwide company. Maybe they knew something we didn't. Well, it turns out they didn't.
After the Milwaukee announcement, Foxconn made plans to open what the company called innovation centers in Racine, Eau Claire, Green Bay, and Madison. These would have been hubs where engineers could work and develop new technology. Foxconn bought buildings, but the workers never came. Kevin Vonk was a development director until August in Green Bay. He worked closely with Foxconn and says for a while it seemed real.
The meetings became fewer and far between. They had some staff turnover, and Green Bay just did not seem that was their top priority.
Foxconn didn't respond to requests for comment on the innovation centers or other questions. Technology and education seemed to be a top priority for the company. In August 2018, Foxconn announced plans to invest $100 million at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. University spokesman John Lucas says the company donated a total of $700,000, less than 1% of what it pledged. It went to research projects at the College of Engineering. Lucas says the university will continue to reach out to companies, including Foxconn, to see if they're interested in additional partnerships. In a statement to WPR, Foxconn representatives say market conditions have changed over the last 3 years. They say they're working with the state on a plan that will benefit Wisconsin taxpayers and give them flexibility. Last October, Racine County Supervisor Jody Spencer joined other elected officials on a tour of Foxconn's Mount Pleasant facility given by the company.
It was a massive building with, I would say, few people working. I guess, to be honest, I didn't know what was real and what was framed up for the touring.
When Foxconn was first announced, Spencer was a mail carrier in Racine. And like a lot of other people, she was doubtful that the company could live up to its promises. She says the tour didn't change her mind. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now, colleges and universities straight across the country have been hit hard a year into the pandemic. Falling enrollment, lost tuition dollars, other revenue streams evaporated. A loss estimate published in the Chronicle of Higher Education last month calculated it at $183 billion, although the federal government has provided relief money with more likely on the way. What are your thoughts on fully reopening campuses? Is it time? Do you expect more layoffs or furloughs at your institution? Should colleges merge or close programs? It's 800-642-1234. Kimo Ayun is provost and executive vice president of academic affairs at Marquette University. Kimo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, this week, Marquette announced plans to reopen campus and the residence halls in the fall. What factors went into making this decision?
Yeah, I will tell you, we're really excited about being open in the fall. We never closed down. We did have to de-densify this semester. But when we think about fulfilling our mission, you know, being in person, giving our students the ability to worship together, be at athletic events together, engage in campus activities, grow together, this was all important. And it's something as we look at, you know, with vaccination rollout happening and where the pandemic is heading, we feel we're in a really good and solid position to be back in person fully in the fall semester.
Well, let's get to vaccines in a moment, but what goes into making a decision like this to be able to gather students in these very public settings, out even, you know, at athletic events you mentioned and in other places, places of worship? You know, what safety measures are you putting in place?
Well, and obviously we're a long way off from August, and so we're months and months. If you think about where we were 6 months ago, it was a much different place. We already see the city beginning to kind of relax where it's heading. You know, I know personally, substantially more faculty are being vaccinated and we're heading in the right place. We'll obviously, you know, monitor what's happening. And like we did this year, we'll put into safety protocols in order to be able to keep our students safe. We have done really well in the spring semester. And in the fall semester, we managed to maintain our campus staying open. We learned a lot.
What did you learn? What were some of those top line takeaways?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm initially obviously mask wearing, making sure people follow appropriate protocols, social distancing, de-densifying our residence halls. So, everything that Fauci has been saying, everything that the CD has said it to follow, it's really worked here.
When you look logistically at, say, residence halls, will you have them at capacity, do you think, do you anticipate?
Yeah, that's our intention, is to have them at capacity. Again, I would say as we're, you know, quite a ways away from the start of the fall semester, we've had to pivot before, meaning that we intended to do one action and we had to move to another action. Everything we are planning, we have a plan B in place and we'll pivot if needed.
Even though we are months away, what are you putting in place now to prepare for the fall? What are the steps look like? It must be very busy.
Yeah, you know, right now on campus, we have substantial quarantine and isolation spaces. We do surveillance testing. We test all symptomatic individuals. So, we have the infrastructure in place to test and to isolate and quarantine. And to the degree to which we will need that in place in the fall semester, we will make sure that we do what we need to do in order to keep our community safe.
Let's look at vaccinations here for a moment. How are they rolling out on your campus? What do you have in place?
Yeah, so we are a vaccine provider. which will allow us to be able to vaccine eligible members as dictated by the state of Wisconsin. The vaccines are in limited supply. When we have the capacity and we have done some vaccination, and people in our highest categories are 1A, our frontline medical people, and our nurse, people who are seeing patients, our nursing students, our physician assistant students, our dental students and staff. So we have the vaccination protocol in place, and getting the actual vaccine is determined by the state, and as we get it, we will continue to distribute it. But I will say that what I'm hearing more and more is, it gets passed around. Our faculty and staff are finding other places in Milwaukee to be able to get vaccinated.
How many vaccines have you administered so far, approximately?
I do not have that number.
Will students and staff be required to get the vaccine for fall?
Yeah, we haven't made that decision yet. That's clearly a conversation we'll need to have before we, reopen. So that is a conversation that's going to happen on campus.
What are faculty most concerned about or asking you about as they prepare to be in person, if they haven't been so already in this pandemic? What are they asking for in terms of PPE and how their classrooms would be set up?
Yeah, as you might imagine, we have a very large faculty population, so it's mixed in opinion. I would say I'm hearing from more faculty that they're excited about being together. They appreciate the conversations that are had in the classrooms, but then also understand, to what degree are we going to be engaging in mask wearing? To what degree will we need to be socially distant in the classroom? We just don't have those answers yet. One of the great things is our faculty have just been tremendous in being flexible, meeting the needs of our students. And so this is something we will collectively work together to fully understand as we get closer to the start of the semester.
What is masking like on campus right now?
Yeah, it's required. So everybody's wearing a mask right now on campus.
Do you feel there's compliance with that?
Yeah, obviously, like in any setting, you have some people who will not comply, but when we see noncompliance, we act on it, and we explain to them what the policies are on campus and require them to wear a mask. And I will say, my office overlooks campus, and it is rare that I see students on campus without a mask. And when I do, they tend to be when they're distanced from everyone else. So definitely when they're in crowds walking on campus, they're wearing their masks.
We have Marquette University Provost Kimo Ayun, who's with us explaining how his institution is approaching this pandemic in the months ahead. Are you concerned about discontinuing majors or merging programs amid the economic fallout? Did your college student take a gap year in the pandemic? What has that been like? Can they get back on track? Are you worried about college affordability amid job losses that have hit so many families? Share your circumstances, your questions about college campuses, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Kimo Ayun here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Marquette University Provost Kimo Ayun. Our country is home to more than 4,000 colleges and universities. Each one is on its own financial roadmap right now to try to emerge from this pandemic intact. We're zooming in on Marquette's situation and decisions moving forward, and Kimo is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in a call now. Marilyn is joining us from Wauwatosa and wanting to address the layoffs. Marilyn, go ahead.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I had to call in and express my concerns about Marquette University. My position was one of the 39 eliminated last month, and I guess looking at that bigger picture, there's been news about the new business school rollout, big investment. While still Marquette is cutting jobs, I've had feedback. We are a three-generation Marquette family, and I've had feedback from our children, who are also alums, that they feel that their alma mater is out of touch with what is going on. I also wanted to say that I think that these job cuts were just truly a drop in the bucket, affecting, you know, many people's lives, while probably not addressing the root problem. And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Marilyn, thank you for sharing those circumstances. Kimo, go ahead.
So obviously, Marilyn, thank you for your, you know, commitment to Marquette. I say a couple of things. The first thing is we're excited about our new business building. It's going to be the first business building in the country built in a post-pandemic world. As far as we know, that building is being built fully supported by our donors. So the total $60 million cost is monies that we raised. And it's great that we have donors who are willing to invest in Marquette. And part of that is they really appreciate our mission and our ability to move forward on our mission. I guess the second part is with respect to cuts. It's been a, you know, difficult industry challenge. 650,000 jobs have been lost in the education industry in 2020. Our goal is we need to make sure we maintain our mission and keep our tuition affordable for our students. We want our students to be able to leave Marquette with the least amount of debt, which does require us to look carefully about how we resource our university. But at the end of the day, it's keep the cost down for our students and maintain a quality Catholic Jesuit education.
So you feel those 39 job cuts were able to relieve the financial pressure that Marquette is experiencing in this pandemic?
Yeah, you know, all of it. I mean, part of that is when we look at positions on campus, you know, it's about growth, and we looked about areas where we had redundancy or areas where we could pick it up in different ways. And so it was, you know, what was the staffing we need to be able to continue to do the good work we're doing?
Will there be more layoffs in the future?
We have none planned at this time, but, you know, we are a tuition-driven institution. 75% of the monies that we bring in comes through tuition. So in large parts, that's, you know, dependent on the students that are here. Like all private institutions, if your revenue is student tuition and your class drops, then you have to, you know, ask, well, how do you realign the university to be able to make sure you can properly fund it? So part of that is we don't know. You know, we know our current year class is 16% smaller than our prior year class. It's our smallest class in the last two decades. Our enrollment is looking good for this next fall semester, but we don't have that set typically until about May 1 when deposits are due.
Why didn't you go down the furlough route, you know, doing more widespread furloughs on campus?
Yeah, you know, when you look at furloughs, when we drop in enrollment, it's a four-year challenge that you have. Because when you drop your class, it's a class for 4 years. We didn't think it was appropriate to furlough our faculty and staff for 4 years. And so, that, you know, we had to address the challenge that we know is a long-term, at least four-year challenge facing us.
When you look at enrollment, you said fall enrollment is looking like it's on track at this point, but it's hard to tell until those deposits do come in and students make those final commitments. Are you concerned about declining enrollment as you look out into the years ahead, as we see a shrinking population base for these coveted students and these young people?
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge all universities are going to have to face. What I feel confident in is we've begun the conversation now. You know, they talk about demographic shifts that are coming in 2026. We know in 2008, the financial crisis hit families and fewer babies were born. But, you know, we're still several years out from that, and we are having conversations on campus in collaborations with our faculty to say, how do we make sure our university has the value add that people are looking forward to receiving? And how do we make sure they understand the value of a Catholic Jesuit education?
We're talking with Kimo Ayun, who is Provost and Executive Vice President of Academic Affairs at Marquette, and we're looking at how Marquette University is navigating these times. Are you a private university student? How has the pandemic affected your college experience? Join in at 800-642-1234. Kimo, you know, you had a very large donation last month with the nursing school, $31 million donation to overhaul the nursing college. What do you aim to do in that area?
Yeah, you know, our mission, Kate, is to serve others. We talk about being men and women for and with others, and I can't think of an area that really is at the center of that than our nurses. You know, we're looking at the possibility of, you know, being able to expand the number of nurses that graduate from Marquette. We know that there is a growing job market for nurses. We know that there is a special need about for people wanting Marquette. They're in high demand. And we're anticipating to, you know, prepare over 5,000 nurses over the next decade and beyond. And that's what we'll do is we'll use this donation by Darren and Terry Jackson to grow the number of nurses and to make it an even better program than it already is.
As you look at your majors, your degree offerings, do you anticipate cutting any programs?
Yeah, there are no programs that we have on the horizon for cutting right now. Like any university, you're always looking about, you know, what's in demand, what is going to be best serve your students, how you might merge programs. And so that's an ongoing process of any university. It's a process we're always going through, but there's not a specific program that is we're targeting right now.
And with the business school and breaking ground there with that new building, do you anticipate that you will change your offerings through the business school at all?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, as we're always looking to be able to create the best experience for our students. And so, you know, part of that is it really gives us the opportunity to rethink. One of the things COVID has done is provided us an insight about how to do really good online education. And I suspect in that space, we're going to have some really creative, innovative spaces that will allow people to be able to teach virtually, but also be able to flex and teach people in person as well.
As we wrap up here, I'm wondering what you could really need now. Of course, you need your students back, you need your faculty back, but are there things that could really help Marquette get back on track financially that you wish you could just, you know, wave a wand and it would be there?
If I could wave a wand, everyone would have a vaccination and we would be on the other side of COVID. When we are in person, that is when we are at our best. And COVID has strained everyone. I want not only for Marquette University, but for families and friends to be able to move freely again. That's what I hope.
Kimo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Kimo Ayun is Provost and Executive Vice President of Academic Affairs at Marquette University. Just ahead, we meet a pair of Wisconsinites who have received the highest honor from the National Endowment for the Arts for their contributions to traditional arts. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.